This is the IBJ Podcast for the week of November the 8th, 2020, brought to you by the law firm Craig DeVault. I'm Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. The gears of democracy rarely seem to move quickly. Sometimes it feels as though someone is feeding us through the gears of democracy. But I think we can say, at least for us Hoosiers, the 2020 election season is over. As we learned on Saturday, November the 7th, former Vice President Joe Biden very likely will become the President of the United States, although President Trump has not yet conceded. With the Democratic administration, we can be sure that a lot would be changing on the federal level, from the drapes in the White House to the highest level policy initiatives at the executive branch. In Indiana, not so much, at least not on the face of it. We obviously have the same governor. State government on the whole remains firmly in the hands of the Republican Party. The northern suburbs in central Indiana that allegedly were leaning Democratic still won for Victoria Spartz in her 5th congressional district race with Democrat Christina Hale. But surely, such a tumultuous election season will have some kind of lasting impact on Indiana. What about the prospects for no-excuses mail-in voting going forward? What about the controversy over the sparse number of early voting centers in Marion County? Governor Eric Holcomb won by a comfortable margin, but he still barely had 50% of the vote. What's he supposed to take from that? What's the 5th district defeat mean for Christina Hale, who did make inroads in what traditionally has been a very Republican district? And what can we expect from Todd Rokita, who might have been the best-known quantity on the ballot across the state, but who now has a new job as Attorney General? We have two guests for the podcast today to help us sort through the results. Laura Merrifield Wilson, who's an assistant professor of political science at the University of Indianapolis, and IBJ's Lindsay Erdody, who covers state government and politics. Now, you'll note up front that our interview was recorded late Friday afternoon, although the outcome of the presidential election wasn't really important for the vast majority of this discussion. Here's our conversation. I'd like to welcome to the IBJ Podcast virtual studio, Laura Merrifield Wilson, who is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Indianapolis. Laura, thank you for making time today. I know it has been a crazy week.
It has, but I'm grateful to be here. Thanks for having me.
And I am happy to welcome back Lindsay Erdody, who covers state government and politics for the Indianapolis Business Journal. That's us. Lindsay, how has your week been?
A little busy, but happy to be here as well.
I think we first need to address the two most newsy things at the moment. As we're recording this on the afternoon of Friday, November the 6th, we still don't know who has won the presidential election. Although Joe Biden overtook President Trump in the Georgia count early this morning, and then in Pennsylvania a few hours ago. Laura, how long is it going to take really to have absolute clarity in this race, even if we call Pennsylvania for Biden at the end of the weekend and he has enough votes in the Electoral College? I mean, when can we really feel like this is over?
Over would be a hard one to say. Clarity is subjective, and I would say at the very least in a couple of weeks, truly from the perspective of even if a victor is declared, and even if we know, okay, with most precincts in, and of course that difference of precincts, meaning if they all went to the opposing candidate, they would still ultimately lose, so it doesn't matter. From a number counting perspective, it could be declared quite quickly, but to have everything else and kind of the clarity in terms of the spread, in terms of the margins, in terms of where everything lies, the overall popular vote, which we know doesn't matter, but still comparing it to the electoral vote. I mean, I truly see that as being a weeks long issue rather than within a couple of days, quite frankly. And even if you think too, with the legal challenges that are being pursued, stuff is going to go into litigation. It's going to be challenged through the courts. Some things may not stick, but others might. It's where I go back to the subjectivity of clarity. I imagine there will be people arguing about the outcome of this election for potentially quite longer than a matter of weeks.
The second bit of big news today is that John Zody, the chairman of the Indiana Democratic Party, announced late this morning that he'll retire in March. And this follows what, I mean, I think you can only describe as a rout by Republicans in the state this week. And Lindsay, you mentioned his exit as a definite possibility earlier today in IBJ's weekly politics newsletter, The Rundown. And it sounds like he was headed out the door one way or the other.
Possibly. I think there are a lot of Democrats that are ready to see some changes in the party leadership. And from what I had heard before John Zodi confirming it today, was that there was a lot of suspicion that he was not going to seek another term. He has already been in there for two terms. By the time we get to March, that'll have been 8 years with him as chair. And I don't think there was a whole lot of suspicion of him sticking around beyond that or trying to stick around beyond that. I think there was some question of whether or not he resigns immediately or resigns before the end of the year or just before the term ends in March. He denied that he would do that. He's going to stay on through March. To him, he said it is kind of inconsequential whether or not he is out of there tomorrow or in March, because in his mind, anyone who's interested in becoming chair can start announcing that today, tomorrow, whenever, and start, you know, making their pitch for how they're really going to help rebuild the party and figure out a whole new strategy for them. Because like you said, this was another bad year for Indiana Democrats. And we saw that in 14, we saw that in 16, we saw it in 18. So it's a bit of a pattern here for Indiana Democrats.
To what extent can we lay, you know, this fallow period at John Zodi's feet? I mean, this year you certainly could make an argument that, you know, having Trump and Pence on the ballot really skewed everything for Indiana.
Yeah. When Zodi was speaking with reporters this morning, he said that he does take, you know, full responsibility for some of the outcomes that we've seen over the years while he's been in charge. But he does also blame the Trump factor for at least some of the losses in 16 and some of the losses this year. And in 16, you know, I think a lot of people, even Republicans, will say that Trump helped push Eric Holcomb over the finish line in the governor's race that year. And if Trump had not won Indiana by 20 points, you may have seen Democrat John Gregg win that race. This year, you're seeing Democrats make similar arguments that Trump helped push some of these Republicans who wouldn't have otherwise won their races get over the finish line. Whether or not that's true, I think we kind of need to see more data come in over the next few weeks and, you know, all this Monday morning quarterbacking continue.
I want to ask quickly about turnout in Indiana this year. Do we have a sense of how many Hoosiers voted and how that would rank in terms of other presidential year elections? Laura, do you know what happened there?
I was going to say, I have a little bit of data. This is one of those clear as mud answers where we can say, well, we don't have the entirety. Yeah. It does look like it was nearly record-breaking. And I was looking at a Washington Post article that I found to be really informative. And they said that we broke a 40-year turnout record in Indiana specifically. They're projecting for the national numbers to be right around maybe 66%. And I always feel like this is a double-edged sword because on one hand, that's great. That's much higher than we've seen, you know, in recent years. And on the other hand, you're also talking about of eligible voters. So we're still not even like hitting the 70% threshold of, or we're not talking about like 17 and 16 year olds, right? They can't vote. And people who aren't American citizens can't vote. People currently serving felony convictions can't vote. Right? Of people who can actually vote, almost 70% chose to. Double-edged sword, but at least if you compare in terms of previous years, this was incredible. And I suspect for a couple different reasons. Regardless, I think it's something we can learn from.
What changed this year?
I'm so glad you asked. Yeah. Well, I do think certainly the process and the procedures, right? So because of COVID, that would be the short, easy answer, right? Well, COVID changed everything. We were able to allow people to participate in early voting. That was expanded. Many states allowed the no excuse mail-in voting. States looked at their procedure laws and they said, how do we make it easier? You know, we don't want to have crazy long lines of people closer than 6 feet together, you know, like coughing on each other and using this as a reason to spread it. So they really did analyze what they had and look to see what they might be able to change. And I do think we'll look back at this year and say, what did we do differently in procedures and process that made it easier for people to participate? The other side of COVID is it as a political issue. And it's hard to think of any policy-related issue, anyone's life who it hasn't touched, right? But even in every regard with the policy issue, if you really care more about education, well, it impacted education. If you care most deeply about the economy, it impacted that too. And just across the board, I think people saw it as a political issue and the way that it impacted their lives, where sometimes I imagine your average voter or potential voter says, just, it doesn't really matter to me who's in charge, right? The issues don't really impact me. I just don't know that much about politics and it doesn't matter. I think that changed this year.
So you mentioned no excuses voting. Yeah. Some states did allow voters to submit ballots via mail without having any preconditions for doing so. Indiana kept its rules in place for determining who could be allowed to mail in ballots. Do we have a sense at all if the state is going to just maintain the status quo, or is there a big enough push to go to a more forgiving system?
I can't imagine a circumstance other than this year where there wouldn't have been a larger push. And the fact that our state resisted, we were one of five states that didn't have the no excuse option for our absentee. You have to qualify under one of the 11 excuses, right? This would be the year, an international pandemic where our state was hit. It just felt like exceptionally hard in some ways. If the governor and the secretary of state's office said, that's not reason enough, there are still other opportunities, people still can engage in different ways. It's hard to imagine us transitioning. And in that said, I will give the caveat, the beauty of federalism, looking at other states. This wasn't the first year that states had ever tried no excuse mail-in voting. Oregon was Washington state. They've been doing this for years. And so we can look at the data they have and say, okay, how does that impact turnout? There's always a concern about it favoring one party or another, but with the exception of 2020, we have to look at that one next. But the literature and political science shows that it's actually kind of mixed because there are demographic groups that support both Republicans and Democrats that benefit from this. And we can learn from our neighbors and decide whether or not we want to adapt or adopt something as our own for the future.
And Lindsay, a lot of people in Marion County were frustrated that there were only a handful of centers for casting ballots before Election Day. I mean, that's kind of a whole fraught process. Is there any reason to think that this is going to change 2 years from now?
That's really hard to say. I think something people need to keep in mind is we actually had more early vote centers in Marion County this year than in previous years. The thing about this year was we were in the middle of a pandemic and we did have such a desire to have early voting, and we didn't have mail-in voting allowed for every single voter. So those people who were concerned about being around a bunch of people on Election Day, their option was go vote early. So I think all of that kind of played into the long lines we saw at some of the early vote centers in Marion County. And the decision to have more is up to the Marion County Election Board, which, to remind everyone, all the election boards have to have a unanimous decision to add vote centers or to make some of these decisions. And the board is made up of two Democrats and one Republican. The Democrats argue that Republicans have been the holdup here, that they haven't been willing to add more vote centers. Republicans push back and say, hey, that's not true. And we'll certainly point to the Republican board member voting this year to allow Lucas Oil to open on the last weekend of early voting in Marion County. And I think that significantly helped decrease the wait times that weekend for early voting.
I was there. That was 8,000 voters over that weekend.
There might almost be a hard sell for it in, you know, say 2 years from now, because the argument may be, well, we're not in the middle of a pandemic, hopefully. Fingers crossed, everybody. You know, it's not going to be a presidential election year, and turnout's usually lower in non-presidential election years. So there may be this thought of, well, we're not going to have as many early voters as we did in 2020. 2020 may be seen as an anomaly for the rush of early voting.
Okay, let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ Podcast.
The IBJ Podcast is brought to you by Krieg DeVault, a trusted and dynamic law firm representing a wide variety of local, regional, and national clients. Committed to each other and to every client, Krieg DeVault prides itself on integrity, professionalism, respect, and excellence. Financial institutions, global manufacturers, national healthcare providers, and successful organizations of all sizes and market focus rely on Krieg DeVault to create innovative and successful business solutions. Connect today at www.kriegdevault.com.
All right, we're back with the latest edition of the IBJ Podcast. We're talking this week with political scientist Laura Merrifield Wilson and IBJ's Lindsay Erdody about the ramifications of the 2020 election on the state level.
Let's go ahead and look at the governor's race. So Governor Eric Holcomb won almost 54% of the vote. Democrat Dr. Woody Myers had 31.7%. and Libertarian Donald Rainwater did very well with almost 15%. So if I'm Governor Holcomb, how do I interpret that? I mean, on one hand, I won by a comfortable margin. On the other hand, I barely got more than half of the vote. Or what do you think he's going to take from that?
Yeah, well, I think for starters, winning is winning. So he will, he'll benefit from that. This to me is a statement more probably about Myers and the Democrats than it is necessarily about Holcomb and the Republicans. And maybe we should also give credence to Rainwater and the Libertarian argument too. That incredible to have nearly 15% for a third party ticket in Indiana, you know, that is a victory in and of itself for what is ultimately a loss and defeat. But I think for Eric Holcomb, this is kind of a referendum and a confirmation on his administration. Certainly there were questions, we heard them in the two debates they had for governors, questions about how he handled shutting down the state. But when you look at these numbers, Eric Holcomb has generally not been very well known until probably March of this year. And then as he's become more known at a time during the virus and the epidemic, people start to recognize like, oh, that's who their governor is. I think he's been fairly popular even in anonymity in some ways. So, you know, when you look at this, yeah, 53, 54% isn't outstanding, but the margin of victory is decisive.
So, Lindsay, do voters give Holcomb any message other than just stay the course?
I don't really think so. I think to Laura's point, if the voters gave any message, it's that the Democratic candidate for governor was not strong enough. That's a pretty low percentage of the vote for a major party candidate to get in a governor's race, especially when you think about he was running for almost a year and a half he had a campaign for. But, you know, he didn't get on TV until the last minute. Donald Rainwater was on TV before him. He struggled to raise money. You know, I don't think any of us are necessarily surprised by the margins that we saw in the governor's race. I think we kind of expected Governor Holcomb to get above that 50% range and to see Donald Rainwater hit historic levels for a Libertarian candidate. Before that, the highest a Libertarian candidate for governor had gotten was under 10%. So, I mean, he did remarkably well.
What does this mean for the Libertarian Party in Indiana? Was Donald Rainwater just an amazingly charismatic candidate, or was the Libertarian cause that really find some traction? Or was it just a COVID-inspired anomaly?
I think it had a lot to do with the COVID response and what we saw Governor Holcomb do, because there were a good number of people that were upset about the mask mandate. There were a good number of people who were upset with the initial shutdown orders in March and April. You know, I covered a protest at the governor's mansion, I believe it was in April, and a lot of people were upset with him then. But at the end of the day, that voting block wasn't big enough. And so I think, you know, Holcomb's campaign all along kind of kept making this point that Woody Myers wanted to impose more restrictions. Donald Rainwater wanted to impose less restrictions. And Governor Holcomb's kind of right here in the middle, this middle ground of where we should, how we should be navigating the pandemic. And I think at the end of the day, you saw voters like that middle of the road approach.
Let me ask about the state house. So Indiana somehow has emerged from the 2020 election as an even sturdier stronghold for Republicans. The GOP already enjoyed supermajorities in both chambers of the legislature, and Republicans this week gained another 4 seats in the 100-member Indiana House. They lost a single seat in the Senate, but it still enjoys like a 39-11 majority. I guess my question is, after living in Indiana for most of my life, is there any reason we should be surprised by this result?
Probably not. Although there was questions like, oh my goodness, Democrats could, and let's be clear, not take over the House, just break the supermajority, when in fact that didn't even happen. When I've thought back on this, why would this be the case? I think the Republican Party benefited from 2 coattail effects. If you didn't like Donald Trump at the top of the Republican ticket, you might have enjoyed Holcomb, right? Because they're 2 very different Republicans, but nonetheless, both of them up there, top of the ticket before you get down to the state legislative races, and vice versa. If you're a really big fan of Donald Trump, you may not really be a big fan of Eric Holcomb, but nonetheless, you're going through your ballot, you may be marking that right side for Republican the whole time. And some of these races were very well funded. I was thinking about that with the governorship too. Woody Myers was chronically under-supported, I think, because there was a lot of focus within the Democratic Party on potentially the ACE-G race, looking at the 5th congressional race. If you had money and you want to support a Democratic candidate in the state of Indiana, you probably weren't necessarily giving it to the governor's race. But for some of these state races, these were very well funded. And some challengers that you saw, it really mount a good challenge, just not successful enough to overtake the incumbents and certainly not to change that supermajority the Republicans now very comfortably enjoy in the Indiana General Assembly.
It is slightly surprising for those of us who are paying attention to it, because we did see some of those state house Republicans heavily invest in their campaigns this year that we have not seen in previous years. You know, I spoke to several Republican state lawmakers who fully admitted that they were campaigning more this year than they had ever before because they were concerned about their opponent. And we really did not see that in previous years. So even though in previous years, Democrats would have argued that they were being competitive then as well, this was really the first time we saw some of those Republicans act like they were concerned. I mean, we saw negative ads against the Democratic candidates for state house races. And I think it's been a long time since you've seen that in some of these seats too.
But it wasn't just a matter of the particular opponents. I mean, wasn't there some talk about how at least the northern suburbs in Indiana were beginning to tilt Democratic?
Yeah, we definitely heard that, I'd say, for the past 2 years leading up to these races. And that's why I think there was some surprise in the results this year. And I think even Republicans are a little surprised that they added seats in the House. Like Laura said, we thought maybe Democrats were going to bust the supermajority in that chamber. And instead, we saw the opposite, and the supermajority gained strength. You know, Indiana Republican Party Chairman Kyle Hupfer sent an email to supporters this week that basically said, you know, we thought 2016 was the highest of highs that we were going to get. And here we are, still continuing to do better and better every election. So, you know, I think Republicans are happy about that, don't get me wrong, but I think it kind of almost caught them off guard too.
Now, I received a call from a reader today, actually. It basically referred to redistricting, saying that the reason why Democrats have performed so poorly over the last decade or so is due to the 2010 redistricting, say that 10 times fast, divvied up the state so Republicans would have an advantage. I don't know if everybody agrees with that, but I guess my question is, when is the next redistricting and who will control it?
So that's going to come up in the next legislative session. And now that we've seen Republicans strengthen their position in the House and essentially keep it the same in the Senate, they're going to be the ones in charge of drawing those lines and making those decisions. So, you know, I've heard this argument that some of the districts are drawn poorly, and I think you can certainly make that argument when you look at some of these lines and what's included and what got carved out in the past redistricting. But at the end of the day, these areas have been there for 10 years now, and you didn't hear Democrats talking about this leading up to Election Day this year. You heard them talking about how the demographics in those districts, as they are drawn, have changed and they can be competitive there. So they didn't seem concerned about that going into Election Day this year. And I'll also say, you can make that argument for state house races, but you cannot make that argument for statewide races. And Democrats haven't had a statewide elected office since Joe Donnelly lost in 2018.
On a related note here, in the 5th congressional district race, Republican Victoria Smarts won with 50.1% of the vote. Democrat Christina Hale had 45.9% of the vote. Libertarian Kenneth Tucker had 4%. What, Laura, was the difference for Victoria Smarts?
Yeah, I think when you look at the difference overall, this was interesting. It looked like it was supposed to be a really close race. And I would say that it was like 5% margin at the end. It was not nearly as close as people thought. She probably benefited from a little bit of that down ballot effect, certainly for Donald Trump. And the big question when we looked at the 5th congressional district, which is an interestingly drawn district in and of itself, we're going to talk about that at the congressional level, is you have what I always think of as Hamilton County, and there's a little bit of Marin County in there too. And then everything else. And that is a diverse district because you're talking about some rural farmland there, right? Which is probably going to be very deep red as it can go, would never ever slip even into the purple color, let alone go to blue. And then Hamilton County, which we questioned, like, would that be enough if you look between Hale and Sparks, would it be enough to switch over? So for me, I think it's the district demographics still favored a Republican candidate, and that's why you saw Sparks victorious. And then probably also a little bit of that ballot, the down ballot effect and the coattail effect, again, that I would say between Eric Holcomb and Donald Trump, very different candidates as far as Republican Party go. But nonetheless, if you are in that party, you like one or the other, that could have an impact on the rest of the way you vote.
You know, in 2018, the margin was 57% for Susan Brooks, the Republican congresswoman at the time, and Democrat Dee Thornton got 43%. So that was a bigger difference that we saw in 2018. Democrats closed the gap slightly in 2020, but it's still interesting to me that with all the money Christina Hale had, she only got 3 more percentage points than Dee Thornton, who had considerably less money in 2018.
Well, and again, when we had lots of polling, since this was such a closely watched race, that indicated, I mean, in the last week before the election, that actually Christina Hale was just edging out on top. What do we make of that?
And polling can be inaccurate, and I hate saying that because then you don't want to delegitimize all of it. So let's just throw it out the window, right? We don't need it. There were a lot of things within the margin of error, and of course, the question is always, you know, if the election were held today, and with early voting and absentee voting, for some people it was. For some people, the election already had been held, and then there were a number of people who chose to vote on election day, so it wasn't the day they were asked. All those caveats aside, I think when you think of this just as a whole, right? She was a really strong candidate. And I think she's probably the strongest candidate the Democrats have had in a long time. And there has to be some sort of opportunity. There has to be an opening. Perhaps it's the change in leadership, the change in position, the change in how they address looking at the offices they have. But I thought Hale did a really good job. The margins and polling were wrong, and they may have impacted, of course, obviously the outcome. And being as wide as it was, I think was a surprise for people.
What is next for Christina Hale? I mean, again, I think that she's really well regarded. She previously was the lieutenant governor candidate in the previous gubernatorial election. Is this a bump in the road for her, or is it a serious problem?
I don't think it's a serious problem for her. You know, I think a lot of people will say she ran a good campaign. I think a lot of people will say, you know, she kind of did everything she could there. From some Democrats I've heard, they think she lost just because of that election day turnout of people wanting to go vote for President Trump. You know, I think a lot of people will still see her as a strong candidate for other offices, and she certainly has ambition. So I'd say this probably isn't the last we've heard of her.
We have a couple of minutes. I wanted to real quick talk about the attorney general's race, where we have a known quantity. We have Todd Rokita, who, am I right, was previous Secretary of State and also a representative in Congress who beat Jonathan Weinzappel, who was previous mayor of Evansville, with, I mean, a little less than 2/3 of the vote. I mean, pretty big margin. What can we expect from Todd Rokita as Attorney General?
Well, he campaigned a lot talking about gun rights and kind of having this proactive role as an Attorney General. I think it'll be interesting in some ways, because when you look at the previous Attorney General with Curtis Hill, there were often times that he seemed combative with Eric Holcomb as governor, and in a proactive way that you don't always see an Attorney General, I think, at the state level doing that. I don't get a sense that Todd Rokita will behave similarly in that regard. But when he talked in the campaign, like, what was he going to do? He emphasized Second Amendment rights, gun rights, those real conservative values. And in particular, Todd Rokita is, as you said, a known quantity in Indiana, very socially conservative, I think a little bit more deep red than some of the other Republicans in the statewide executive offices. And so he'll bring that flavor in there as well.
I agree with all of that that's been said. I think one of the things he said over the course of the campaign was, you know, check my record, look at what I've done in my previous office experiences. That's what you're going to get from me as Attorney General. And I don't think he's given us any reason to believe otherwise. You know, I think he's going to be pretty conservative. To me, I think what will be interesting is, depending on how the presidential race plays out, and if we do end up with a President Joe Biden, how much Todd Rokita pushes back on some things the Biden administration tries to do, versus if we end up with President Trump in a second term, how much Todd Rokita tries to support what the Trump administration is doing.
Yeah, that led into my last question, which is, let's say that the votes continue to trend the way they're going. We have a Biden-Harris administration. Does anything change for Indiana?
Generally, I want to say not a lot, just because of the how red our state is right now and the impact of state government and local government on your daily life versus federal. I mean, of course, things change for the country and the direction as a whole. So with that regard, we would be included in the 49 other states. But for the outcomes that we saw in this election, especially at the state level, it seemed to be resounding in the Republican victory that we saw.
Yeah, I'm not sure we'll see a whole lot change. I mean, as we've talked about, we're still going to have a Republican governor, Republican attorney general, and Republican strongholds in the state house. And those are the people who are going to be passing and enforcing laws that are impacting Hoosiers every day.
So I guess we just keep our eyes peeled here for something happening this weekend, maybe?
I know. I was kind of hoping it would happen today because I don't want to brush my hair tomorrow.
My thanks again to Laura Merrifield Wilson and Lindsay Erdody. Before you get on with the rest of your week, I want to draw your attention to several of the strong stories kicking off the latest issue of IBJ. First up, passenger traffic at Indianapolis International Airport is expected to be 45% lower in 2020 than last year, but airport leaders say they are confident they can keep the organization's finances stable. Sam Quinn examines the flight plan through turbulent skies over the next several years. Also, in this week's issue, Mickey Shuey reveals which Indianapolis hotels are under the most pressure from lenders as they stare down massive debt payments over the next few years. And Susan Orr takes a closer look at how consumers are avoiding taking out new loans and instead beefing up their savings, leading to enormous growth in bank deposits. Again, you can find these stories in IBJ's latest print edition or online at IBJ.com. Of course, it's quite a bit easier to access IBJ's nearly bottomless trove of stories and vital statistics about Central Indiana's business community and economy if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for authoritative and actionable information that you're not going to get anywhere else. And you can be sure that we're going to be all over the repercussions of the election and what it means for Central Indiana. So go to IBJ.com and click on the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.